Okay, I want to start off by saying a little bit more about net consumption. Now here we have a diagram that's very, very similar to ones we've looked at in the past. We started several weeks ago with figures 14.4 and 14.5, I believe, just dealing with capital accumulation. And that is continued here. And then we went on to, I think, figures 15, 5, and 6, which were an elaboration and showed how you could derive national income along the way. Now here,
the figure in question here is figure 16.2 on page 732 of Capitalism.
Have the familiar 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor. They're engaged in production, and we're assuming they're used initially to produce a fresh 1K of capital goods and 1C of consumer's goods. The capital goods that are initially available in year one, well, what happens to them? They're used up in producing the output that's available at the start of year two. And just as before, we had that this is in response to 500 of demand for capital goods and 500 of demand for consumers' goods. And as we have also already seen, this 500 of demand for capital goods is simultaneously 500 of sales revenues to the sellers of the capital goods. It will also result in 500 of cost on account of capital goods to the buyers next year when they sell the products the capital goods are used to produce. And similarly, the 500 of demand for consumers' goods is simultaneously 500 of sales revenues to the sellers of the consumers' goods. And it results, and here's a further elaboration, it results from the payment of 300 of wages by business, which the wage earners consume, plus 200 of consumption expenditure by businessmen and capitalists. The 300 of wages also result in 300 of cost on account of labor next year, when the products the wage earners help to produce are sold. So here we are. The only advance, really, the only greater complication is that now we've introduced the payment of wages into the picture. Previously, we'd only gotten as far as allowing for the expenditure for capital goods and the fact that that expenditure would show up as cost. But now we're allowing for the fact that there's 300 expended to employ labor. 300 is spent for the 1L of labor. Now, here we are. As of year two and thereafter, we're up and running. What's going on here, in each period of time, business firms are spending 500 units of money to buy capital goods. They're spending a further 300 units of money to pay wages. And they spend 200 units of money via dividends and draw payments to finance the consumption expenditure of their owners. So what will be sales revenues, total sales revenues in each of these years? Yes? 1,000. And how do you get the 1,000, Ms. Foley?
500, 300, and 200.
All right, 500, 300, and 200, exactly. 500 is expended to buy capital goods. That's 500 of receipts from the sale of capital goods to the sellers of those capital goods. 300 is expended to pay wages. What do the wage earners do with their wages? They buy consumers' goods. So that's 300 more of sales receipts. And there's 200 paid in the form of dividends, draw, and interest payments. And what do the recipients of those payments do? They buy consumers' goods. So we have 500 demand for consumers' goods, and we're seeing now where it comes from. And we see total sales revenues. Total sales revenues in the economy are 1,000. Now, in year two, that's not enough to tell us what profit is, because we don't have any monetary values on the 1K of capital goods here, or on the 1L of labor, but we do down here, in year two and thereafter. The 1K of capital goods, we show at a cost of 500. Well, why do we show them at a cost of 500? Why do we show these capital goods here, this 1K of capital goods, at a cost of 500?
That was the demand.
That's what was spent to buy them. And we say this 500 of demand for capital goods is sales revenues to the sellers. It will also result in 500 of cost on account of capital goods to the buyers next year when they sell the products the capital goods are used to produce. Well, here, they haven't yet sold any products. We're just showing they're using capital goods in production. And what did they pay for those capital goods, those 1K of capital goods?
500
units of money. And they're also employing 1L of labor along with it. And what is the cost of that?
300,
because they paid 300. So the total means of production cost what?
800.
And if they're employed 50% to produce capital goods and 50% to produce consumers' goods, and they physically succeed in producing 1K of capital goods and 1C of consumers' goods, well, what would be the respective cost values of these goods? 400 each, that's half of 800. 500 and 300 gives us the 800, and half of the labor and capital goods are used to produce fresh capital goods for year three and consumers' goods for year three. And they both have cost values of 400, because 800 was the total amount spent for means of production, half of which are used to produce each of these categories of products. Well, so here we are. We know what the cost of each of the goods is. It derives from the outlays for the means of producing them. And now, what will be sales revenues in year three?
800.
Okay, I hear one answer is 800 of sales revenues. Do I hear any other offers, a higher offer?
1,000.
Okay, I hear 1,000. Why 1,000, not 800?
Same situation. You have to consider the consumption of the businessmen and capitalists in combination with the 300 of wages that subsequently will be spent, and an additional 500 that's reinvested into capital for the
next. Okay, exactly. You see, we're assuming year in and year out. Year in and year out, 500 is being expended to buy capital goods, 300 is expended to pay wages, and 200 is dividends, draw, and interest. And we're assuming all the wages, all the dividends, draw, and interest are consumed. So consumption spending is 500, demand for capital goods is 500, so sales revenues are 1,000. Well, what are the costs to be deducted from those sales revenues?
400.
Pardon me?
800 total, 400.
800 total, 400 against each of the 500s of sales revenues. And so what does that tell us about total profit in this setup?
200.
It's 200. Now notice, year in and year out, we're going to have the same situation. This is still, it's a stationary economy. The situation will remain the same. Let me get rid of that thing. All right, year in and year out, 1,000 of sales revenues are being generated. What's generating them? Well, 500 of demand for capital goods, 500 of demand for consumers' goods. Where does the 500 of demand for capital goods come from? Who's making the 500 demand for capital goods?
Who's
making the 500 of demand for capital goods?
Capitalists and
businessmen. Business firms are making 500 of demand for capital goods. Who's making the demand for labor?
Business
firms. We're assuming it's 300. And we're assuming they're also paying out 200 in dividends, draw, and interest payments. Okay, how much money comes back to business firms in the sale of their products?
1,000.
They continually have 1,000 of sales revenues. And what does that permit them to do in the following year? to repeat the same operations. They've all together, in total, expended $1,000, but in total they also receive $1,000, right? Because what business buys, it's only a question of time that business sells. Certainly what business buys from other business firms instantaneously have the same sales receipts, right? What about the money paid to the wage earners?
It goes into consumer's goods.
That's going to go into consumer's goods. Now, it's possible that it wouldn't all come back immediately in the same period of time. We could allow for that. But the simplest procedure is to assume it does come back in the same period of time. Ultimately, it certainly will. What will people do with the money otherwise?
They'll save
it. Well,
now, even if they save and reinvest it, would they normally be putting it under the mattress?
No.
No. So it will be coming back as part of the demand for capital goods. One way or another, it's going to come back. And now it might be that some people are paid and then they disappear off a wharf and they have money in their pockets and they drown with it and it's their body is never found and this money is lost forever. Okay, is this something significant? That was very significant, the guy who's lost his life, but is it significant in terms
of... would have got the insurance.
It's not significant in terms of the loss of funds. And also, every year, what in fact is going on with respect to the quantity of money?
Increasing.
It's increasing. So such situations would mean it would be equivalent to a little bit less of an increase. And even if it was zero increase, the decrease would be inconsequential. Yes.
Kind of question off the path, but
yeah,
that's okay. I'm curious, is there any estimation as to how much counterfeit money is put into the system in any given year? A friend of mine came across the counterfeit 20 just this week.
Oh, really?
It felt a little bit different, but it looked exactly the same. I just wonder how much of that they
I have no idea. I'm sure there are estimates on it. And
we looked it up earlier in the trimester.
Yeah.
It was
how much?
I think 120 million.
Really?
120 million?
I think. Yeah, we looked it up earlier in the track.
Okay, where did you find it?
Google.
Oh, you just looked under counterfeit?
FBI.gov.
Okay. I'm surprised if it's not more. I mean, that's, there's over it. There's hundreds of billions.
We went back to the store where he got it, and they said, well, we don't know that you switched bills on us. It's yours now.
How do you know it's counterfeit?
I guess. I'm not sure exactly how bad it was. I mean, it looked like the real thing. It just felt different. The only difference was it felt a little bit waxy compared to a regular bill.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you be able to go to the bank and get that and say, hey, this is,
no.
I got this?
No.
Why not?
Do you have a laser pointer or printer at home?
It's not their responsibility.
Right. They take it from them.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
All right. I don't know. Now, main point here is that in this process, there's a profit being generated. Note, if you track it out each year here, you can see what are sales revenues. They're going to be 1,000 year in and year out. And costs are going to be 800 year in and year out. We can see where do the sales revenues come from? Well, they come from business firms, directly or indirectly. Business firms are buying capital goods. That generates a huge chunk of the sales revenues. They're also paying wages. That's the source of the great bulk of consumer demand. And over and above that, what are they also paying?
Dividends,
draw, and interest payments. And that is a source of consumer demand too, right? Okay, now we're saying here that each year there's 800 of costs. Where do they come from? Where do the 800 of costs come from?
Wages.
Right, there's wages. And how much are they?
300.
That's 300. And then there's the cost on account of capital goods. That's 500 more. So have we overlooked anything? We have 800 of costs. Now, you can say, well, what about interest payments? Well, interest payments do represent a cost, but we're ignoring interest as a cost because we're taking profits as inclusive of interest. We're taking profits gross of interest. So if every year we have 1,000 of sales and 800 of costs, then we have 200 of profit. Well, what is it that makes this possible? What makes it possible in this setup for the sales revenues year in and year out to exceed the costs?
Demand.
Well, what about demand?
Demand for capital goods. Demand for capital goods can combine with the demand for labor.
Yeah.
It's driving the overall profit.
Well, there's demand for capital goods and demand for labor, and how much is that?
800.
That's 800. But how much are sales revenues?
1,000.
1,000. What is it that allows the sales revenues to regularly and consistently exceed the costs? Yes, Mr. Rosenberg.
Because they're done in different periods. We're allowed to subtract the costs in a later period.
Well, the costs and the sales revenues, the expenditures that constitute the costs are made in an earlier period. That's true.
But consumption drives it.
But is this what explains the excess of sales over costs?
No.
Pardon me?
Because it's a stationary economy.
Well, it's a stationary economy, that's true.
It's going to allow for that
consumption of businessmen and capitalists.
It's the consumption of businessmen and capitalists that's permitting the sales revenues to be greater than the costs.
But isn't that only that consumption maintains the same?
Well, we're assuming it is the same here. And what allows the profits to be the same is that the sales revenues exceed the productive expenditure. So here we are. What we have here is, in each year, what is business expending for the means of production?
800.
What is its sales revenues in each year?
1,000.
Now, notice the productive expenditure of any given year shows up as the cost of what year? The cost of the following year, right? Okay, well, if sales revenues exceed productive expenditure year in and year out, and productive expenditure represents costs 1 year later, well, then sales revenues exceed the costs equal to the productive expenditure. The key question is, what is it that allows the sales revenues to be greater than the productive expenditure? Because that's what explains how sales revenues will be greater than costs that themselves are equal to productive expenditure.
You're getting at consumption.
Pardon me?
You're getting at consumption, correct?
But well, what consumption?
Consumption via consumers.
No, businessmen and capitalists.
Ultimately, businessmen and capitalists, it's because of them providing the wages and the capital investment that there's anything in the economy altogether.
Yeah, but we're interested specifically, that's true, but we're interested specifically in what allows the excess of sales over costs.
Consumer demand.
Well, if it's just consumer, you could have the same consumer demand. Suppose we had business firms paying 500 of wages,
mm-hmm.
and there was no net consumption. What would consumer demand be?
Zero.
Pardon me?
It would be zero. There's no consumer demand of 500 wages.
I said there's 500 of wages. What will the wage earners do with their wages?
500 of consumption.
There'll be 500 of consumption. But if there were 500 of wages paid, what would be costs on account of labor?
500.
So we'd still have 500 of consumption, but now we'd have 500 of cost on account of wages, right? And what would be total sales and total costs?
1,000.
Both would be 1,000. So what would be profit?
Zero.
So is it the 500 of consumption that's responsible for profit if in one case there's 200 of profit and in the other case there's no profit?
No, it's the dividends and interest payment.
It's what's key to profits is the excess of consumption over and above wage payments. It's the fact that consumption is greater than wages. Now, why is that key? Well, that's what allows sales revenues to be greater than productive expenditure taken altogether and greater than total costs. Now notice, wages, the payment of wages shows up equivalently in costs, right? And we can assume it will show up equivalently in sales revenues, in the demand for consumers' goods. But in order for there to be profit, we have to have sales greater than costs. Now the demand for capital goods shows up both in costs and in sales revenues. Productive expenditure is not what is responsible for profit. Productive expenditure generates costs equal to itself and sales revenues equal to itself. How is there profit there?
Because
I mean, you could have profit if productive expenditure were growing from year to year, and the costs were always lagged to reflect prior productive expenditures. What development would explain that? Which we spent some time on last week. Yes?
It has something to do with the businessmen and capitalists are not being paid the wages, so that whatever money that they make as a profit, then they're ending up spending, and that is how the sales revenue is exceeds.
Well, you're starting with profit. You're starting with profit.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what is generating the profit? Imagine that we had a year there was no profit. Sales revenues are 1,000, costs are 1,000. There's zero profit. Okay, but suppose now out of the 1,000 of sales revenues, the businessmen and capitalists consume 200. How much productive expenditure can they make?
800.
Now, what are the sales revenues generated by their 200 of consumption plus the 800 of productive expenditure?
1,000.
Now, next year, the same thing is going to happen. They'll have 200 of consumption and 800 of... let's even assume next year they won't consume. Let's assume next year...
consumption.
Next year, the businessmen don't consume. Next year, once again... they'll pay 500 in demand for capital goods and 500 of wages. But next year, when they again have sales revenues of 1,000, what will their costs be if the costs reflect the productive expenditure just of this year?
500.
Well, what's the total productive expenditure this year?
1,000. 500,
oh,
capital expenditure
plus the labor? Yeah. 1,000. 800. Yes? 800. It was 800. We assume that this year they took in 1,000 of sales revenues, they had 1,000 of costs, zero profit. But now they still have the 1,000 that they've taken in, that's theirs, right? And we assume that they consume 200 and they only expend 800 for productive expenditure. Now, how much is gonna show up as costs next year if all the costs are the reflection of the productive expenditure of 1 year before? Next year costs will be 800, right? But what will sales revenues be next year?
1,000.
What's permitting the sales revenues of next year to exceed the costs?
The previous year's productive expenditure.
The fact that the productive expenditure of the year before was less than the sales of next year. Why is the productive expenditure of this year less than the sales of this year?
Additional consumption over wages.
Because the businessmen are consuming. See, to the extent, look at it this way. To the extent that they consume instead of productively expend, what will be the effect on the costs deducted from sales revenues? To the extent that their consumption takes the place of productive expenditure, to the extent that consumption expenditure goes up and productive expenditure goes down, what other key element is going down? If there's less productive expenditure, what else is there going to be less of? Less cost. To the extent that consumption takes the place of productive expenditure, costs go down. But consumption is just as good a source of sales revenues, right? What business firms, what their owners consume, that generates sales revenues, just as much as the wages they pay their workers, and just as much as what they spend for capital goods. So what happens is you have the sales revenues, but you have less costs. Imagine that something happens that wipes out profit. There are no profits in the economy. Okay, what factor is at work operating to restore profits?
Well, the IRS wants profits.
But if there are no profits being earned, they don't have them. They can't get them.
Productive expenditures are driving them.
Well, if we have productive expenditures, what costs should we expect as far as productive expenditures go?
Wages.
We should expect costs that will be equal to the productive expenditures. Unless what?
Consumption over the block.
Well, unless you had net investment going on. But what happens if the funds productively expended will show up as cost within a defined time, next year. The productive expenditures will show up as costs next year. Well, then you have costs equal to the productive expenditures. If productive expenditures were the only source of sales revenues, what would be your problem?
There'd
be zero profits. Okay, now, let's say we're in a situation there are zero profits. There's no profit in the economy.
Okay.
Well, this relates to a subject I have in Supplement 5, so let's deal with that. The inherent springs to profitability. And the first one I refer to is the net consumption spring to profitability. Now, let's say we're starting off, there's zero profit. It's been all wiped out. Businessmen and capitalists are typically pretty wealthy, right? Now, suppose Microsoft earned nothing in a given year. Imagine they had zero profit. And Warren Buffett had no profit.
Okay.
And Dell had no profit. Are they going to go starve?
No,
will they have to go out on the street with a tin cup and say, I haven't made any money this year. Can I have a dime or a dollar for a cup of coffee?
I doubt it.
No, what? How appreciably do you think their personal level of consumption will be affected?
Not very much.
What governs their personal level of consumption?
Savings.
Their accumulated capital, right? It's their accumulated capital. So if you have someone who's a multimillionaire or billionaire, but this year he's earning no income, but he still has several billions of capital, what kind of standard of living do you think he's still going to have?
Very nice one.
They'll still have a very high standard of living, maybe not quite as high, but still very substantial. What's governing his consumption is not his current income, but his accumulated wealth, his capital.
Right.
Okay, now, to the extent that businessmen and capitalists have capital, even if they had zero income for a year or a few years, so long as they have capital, they would still consume. And to the extent that they're consuming, what is the relationship between the sales revenues being generated in the economy and productive expenditure?
The sales revenues will exceed the productive expenditures.
Now, in order for that not to represent profit, in order for an excess of sales revenues over productive expenditures not to represent an equivalent profit in the economy, what would have to be true of costs relative to productive expenditures?
They would have to be equal.
Well, if costs and productive expenditures were equal, and sales revenue is greater than productive expenditure, then what's implied
less
about sales revenue relative to profit, relative to costs? The sales revenues would be greater than costs, and which would mean?
Profit.
We'd have profit. Now, the only way that you would have net consumption and not have profit is if and to the extent that costs exceeded productive expenditure. You see, we could have a situation where sales revenues and costs are equal, and sales revenues at the same time are greater than productive expenditure. Sales revenues are 1,000, productive expenditure is 800, costs are 1,000. That could happen. If that were the case, what would have to be true? What would have to be going on with respect to something else that we've spent a lot of time on? If sales and costs are equal, but sales nevertheless exceed productive expenditure, so costs have to exceed productive expenditure, what does that imply? What does an excess of costs over productive expenditure mean?
Growing supply of money.
Costs.
Loss.
Well, there's a loss, or it's wiping out profit. There's no profit. If costs are greater than productive expenditure, if depreciation allowances are greater than productive expenditure for plant and equipment, what does that imply?
There's more consumption expenditures than there are productive expenditures.
No, we have, that's not the relevant issue. If expenditure for capital equipment is less than current depreciation, what is going on in the balance sheet?
Negative
investment?
Negative net investment. That's happening in the balance sheet. Productive expenditure on account of inventory and work in process is less than cost of goods sold, what's going on in the inventory account? Negative net investment in inventory. Well, it is possible to have a zero profit situation or even a loss situation in circumstances in which sales revenues exceed productive expenditure, but in order for that to be possible, costs have to exceed productive expenditure to the same extent, and that implies that you have equivalent net disinvestment. You have negative net investment.
That's how he's living. That's how the business owner of capitalists is living. He's living off of, by selling his investments.
Okay, now there can be a negative investment for a time, and the capitalist is reducing his savings, but do you think we can have negative investment as a permanent phenomenon?
No.
What will happen as soon as the negative net investment comes to an end? As soon as net investment goes from negative to zero, what's implied about costs? Suppose we have a constant level of productive expenditure. Productive expenditure is 800 per year. We have had costs of 1,000 per year, but we can't have that continuing indefinitely. So what is going to happen to costs at that point? Net investment,
seed investment
stable comes to zero rather than being negative. What has to happen to stop the continuation of negative net investment?
Productive expenditure on investment.
Lower cost.
Pardon me?
Isn't it lower cost?
Costs have to be cut back. Costs have to be reduced. And how will costs be reduced? Well, how do you stem the excess of cost of goods sold over current expenditure for inventory and work in process? What would reduce the amount of cost of goods sold?
You can outsource, you can improve technology.
Well, the cost of goods sold that you're occurring, not not a calculation of unit costs. Here we are, we have a firm, it finds... What will reduce, in order to reduce cost of goods sold, what serves to reduce cost of goods sold? Pardon me?
Lower sales.
If you reduce the physical volume being sold, right?
Right.
If you reduce the physical volume being sold, and what will serve to reduce the physical volume being sold? Well, a rise in prices will do it, right? Now, when that happens, when the physical volume being sold is cut back to be commensurate with the physical volume currently being produced, so we don't have continuing decumulation, at that point, if sales are greater than productive expenditure, what must be happening? If we've cut costs back to conform to productive expenditure, and sales are greater than productive expenditure, and now costs are being cut back to equal productive expenditure.
Profit.
Now profit comes back into existence. The only way that profit would not exist when you have net consumption is if and to the extent there were equivalent net disinvestment, negative net investment. But that cannot be a permanent phenomenon. The implication is that profits spring back into existence on the foundation of net consumption. They will jump back into existence as soon as negative net investment ends. Now, there are further phenomena, and we might as well deal with them. Let me just jump to what I refer to as the direct net investment greater capital intensivity spring, which will also help to explain why we would not have continuing negative net investment. And this may very well sound counterintuitive. The lower is the rate of profit, the greater is the degree of capital intensiveness that becomes worthwhile. Normally, the way we look at things is if something is yielding a very low profit, you think, well, we don't want to invest in that at all. Why invest for a low profit, let alone a loss? And there's a major element of truth in that, but we have to distinguish between when that is true and when it isn't. If you have certain investments that are yielding a lower rate of return than could be obtained in other investments, which ones will you want to make? The ones that yield a higher rate of return. So if we have a particular industry which is taking a loss or earning a minimal profit, that will serve to expel capital. People will want to withdraw capital that they have invested. They certainly won't want to add to the capital invested. They'll want to move somewhere else. And that's all very true insofar as we're talking about rates of return in one industry relative to rates of return in another. We want to get out of the low-yielding industries into the higher-yielding industries. But, yes, Mr. Moraski?
This is a question that off the subject for a minute, but we were discussing this weekend about Walmart, how Walmart has actually destimulated the economy almost because of their demands that they're putting on producers, because they want everybody to produce cheaper for them, and they have such a high market that it is true that they that people have to reduce their costs in order to be able to produce for Walmart.
Okay.
In turn, because of that, the economy hasn't been rising like it should.
The whole economy has not been rising because of Walmart?
Well, because of Walmart and their, they have such a large market share in the industry that they put such demands on producers to reduce their costs in order that for producers to make a profit. Because they have, like, you know, in our business, Walmart consists of 30% of our total business.
Uh-huh.
And in order to do so, they have such a, I don't know where this came from. I was just thinking of it at the moment. But is that, have you heard any studies about what Walmart has been doing to the, to raise, to increase the economy's wealth? Or
don't they stimulate the economy by forcing producers to be more
efficient,
profitable, so look for ways to cut costs?
But because of the cutting of costs, isn't it?
The only way
it's
slowing
down,
more efficient,
they produce more.
Keeps prices down, so everything's cheaper.
I would say Walmart has added considerably to the economy. There's a larger variety of goods available because of them and at lower prices. But you're raising a good example, and hopefully it'll apply to the instances you have in mind. And you'll see if it will within a couple of minutes. I made the point that if we're comparing the rate of profit in one branch of the economy, one industry, with the rate of profit in other branches, an industry that has a relatively low rate will be disfavored. You won't want to invest in such an industry. You want to get out and into other industries that yield a better rate of profit. But now we're going to look at the rate of profit from a somewhat different perspective. Not the rate of profit in one industry relative to other industries, but the rate of profit throughout the economy. And we want to ask, what is the effect of a lower rate of profit throughout the whole economy on investment? Will people decide to invest less in the economy as a whole if the rate of profit is lower? That they will decide to invest less in a given industry if its rate of profit is lower than you can find in other industries, but will they want to invest less if the rate of profit throughout the whole economy is less?
Yes.
Well, I would
unless,
say...
Unless the real wages were up.
I would say no, they will want to invest more. They will need to invest more. Yes, when the rate of profit is low, the lower the rate of profit, the more you need to invest. Now, I know this sounds counterintuitive, so I'm going to proceed to give you a series of examples which I think will convince you. I hope will convince you. We'll start off with the following case, which I think of as the railroad tunnel case. Now, let's imagine that there's a railroad somewhere, and it's choosing between two different possible routes. One route is to dig a tunnel through a mountain. But if you do that, that's initially a lot more expensive. It requires a big capital investment to dig the tunnel. If you do dig the tunnel, you will thereafter have a shorter route. You'll have a permanent saving on crew time, on wear and tear of the locomotives, on fuel. Let's take some hypothetical numbers. We'll keep them small. I know today nothing is realistic below at least $100 million. Let's imagine we're at a time when you could build some kind of railroad tunnel for a paltry $1 million. And the annual saving in crew time, fuel consumption, etc., is $50,000 a year if you have the tunnel. So if you put up this $1 million, you'll be able to reduce your operating costs $50,000 a year. Now, in what circumstances would it pay to dig the tunnel? Well, let's imagine in one set of circumstances, the prevailing rate of return on capital is 10%, which means if you have $1 million available, you should be able to invest it and get a $100,000 return. So would it be a good idea to invest this million to reduce your operating costs by $50,000? No, it wouldn't be a good idea, right? It's a sub-marginal profit venture. But what if the prevailing rate of return on capital, instead of being 10%, were only 4%? Then wouldn't this kind of investment pay? It would be comparatively profitable to invest $1 million to save $50,000 per year. So notice, in this example, a lower rate of return means that the investment will be worthwhile. Well, that's one type of situation. Then there are numerous others. And let me see if we can come up to them relatively easily. All right, let's... let's see what we come up with here. Okay, the inherent springs to profitability. Okay, here's a further example. All right, let's imagine we have a product that can be produced by three different methods of production. I'm reading, looking here at the bottom of the left-hand column. It can be produced in a given quantity by any of three different methods of production, representing three different degrees of capital intensiveness. And you could understand these different degrees of capital intensiveness in terms of the proportion carried on by manual labor versus the portion carried on by machinery. So we have three different methods of production, A, B, and C. And where is table 16.6? Well, here it is. Okay, now the capital required in each of these methods is 10,000 is required in method A, 20,000 in method B, 30,000 in method C. Obviously, each succeeding one is more capital intensive than the one before. And we have annual production costs. Using method A, the annual production cost is 9,000. Using method B, the annual production cost is 8,000. Method C, it's 7,000. Now, is this unreasonable?
Nope.
If you want to cut costs, one major way to do it is to use more or more advanced machinery and equipment. That's how you cut costs, you make such investments. All right, let's examine the comparative profitability of these different methods under different possible sales revenues. In one case, labeled parenthesis one, we'll have annual sales revenues of 11,000. You get 11,000 of sales revenues, whichever method you're using, because each method produces the same physical quantity of the same quality of product. Okay, if the sales revenues are 11,000, then what is the rate of profit using method A, where the annual production costs are 9,000 and the capital invested is 10,000? 2,000 is the annual profit. What's the rate of profit on method A? Yes?
20%,
2,000 divided by 10,000. Now, at the same time, what is the annual amount of profit on method B when the sales revenues are 11,000?
3,000.
And what is the rate of profit on method B given that the capital that needs to be invested is 20,000? It's only 15%, right? 3,000 divided by 20,000. And what about on method C, which is the most capital intensive process?
4,000.
4,000 of profit and 30,000 of capital invested. That's 2 over 15. That's 13 1/3%. So method C is the least profitable. So which method would you use in these circumstances? Method A. Method A is the most profitable. It's the least capital intensive. But now, suppose conditions start to tighten. Walmart is on your tail. And you had been selling your output to Walmart for $11,000, but now they're requiring that you sell it for only $10,000. And that's annual sales revenues number two. We're now at this level of sales revenues. So the sales revenues will be lower, whichever method is used. Now here we are. What is the amount of profit using method A?
1,000.
It's now 1,000 instead of 2,000.
10%.
What's the rate of profit for method A?
10%.
10%, okay. What's the amount of profit for method B?
2,000.
2,000. We have 10,000 of sales, 8,000 of costs, so that's 2,000 of profit. And the rate of profit for method B?
10%.
It'll be 10%. Notice they're now equal. A used to be more profitable compared to B, but now they're equalized. And what about method C?
3,000.
With method C, the amount of profit is 3,000, and the what's the rate of profit?
10%.
Now all three methods are on the same footing.
Yeah.
Okay, what happens, though, if Walmart comes back and drives you down still further?
Yep.
So now Walmart is requiring that if you're going to do business with them, you have to deliver your goods for 9,000. All right, what does that do to the profitability of method A?
Zero.
It wipes it out altogether. What happens to the profitability of method B?
Zero.
Method B is not zero.
Oh, B.
There's still 1,000 of profit on method B. And what's the rate of profit with method B?
5%.
But what about method C? There's still 2,000 of profit with method C. It's the lowest cost method here, and the 2,000 of profit there on the 30,000 of capital invested, well, that's 6.67%. So which is now the most profitable method?
C.
Now, this is a leading way in which a decline in the rate of profit tends to be accompanied by greater capital intensiveness, not less capital intensiveness.
Right.
Because in order to be profitable in the face of declining sales revenues, you need to cut your costs. And how do you cut your costs? What's a major way to cut costs?
To reduce your production cost.
And how do you reduce the production cost?
Bigger factory.
You become more efficient, you have more capital intensive methods. So to this extent, the implication of a low rate of profit is more capital intensiveness. Now there are further examples we can use along the same lines, and I assume many of you have calculators or a spreadsheet program on your computer. Okay, I think we may have referred to the case of older and younger whiskeys. Okay, now if you've ever tasted 20 or 30 year old scotch, I'm sure if you like scotch at all, you'd agree that it's much better than 8 year old scotch. Why?
Some right now?
Yes, naturally. It's supplied by the Board of Trustees of the University.
Yeah. Depends on the barrels it's aged in.
Pardon me?
It depends on the barrels it's aged in.
Well,
it'd be old barrels.
Everything is in oak barrels or whatever.
Okay, well, that's certainly a factor, but I think the older scotch, at least up to 30 or 40 years, is better. Now, why, since it's better, I mean, it's a superior product, I don't think there's much dispute about that, why isn't all the scotch 30 or 40 years old instead of this 8, 12-year-old stuff? It's a lot more expensive, right? It's a lot more expensive. Yes.
Well, the reason it's more expensive is the same reason we talked about last time, because they're deferring their profit for 30 years. Who wants to do that?
Okay, that's right. It's more expensive because whatever the rate of profit is on the 30-year-old scotch, that rate of profit has to compound for 30 years. On the 8-year-old scotch, it only has to compound for 8 years.
So they're just getting started today. They got to wait a long time.
Right. Now, the point is that the difference in price will correspond mainly to the difference in time on which the rate of profit has to compound. Now, if you have a calculator or a spreadsheet program, try working these numbers. We'll assume initially a 10% rate of return, and you just want to calculate what is 1.1 to the eighth. What's 1.1 to the eighth?
2.14.
Okay, 2.14. What's 1.1 to the
30th? 17.44.
Okay, 17.44. Now, 17.44 over 2.14, what's the ratio? How much more valuable is that 30-year-old scotch compared to the 8-year-old scotch? What's the ratio of valuation? On the order of 8 times as much. Okay, now plug in a different rate of return. Plug in a 5% rate of return. So we'll have 1.05 to the 8th and 1.05 to the 30th.
1.47.
1.47 is for the 8-year-old.
Yeah, and 4.32.
4.32. And what's the ratio of valuation now? 2.9, and the other was 8 to 1?
Yep.
Okay, so now notice, now under with a 5% rate of return, the 30-year-old scotch is less than 3 times more expensive rather than 8 times more expensive. With that relative valuation, which drink do you think scotch drinkers would prefer more heavily? Wouldn't there be a shift in demand from the 8-year-old to the 30-year-old when you have such a reduction in the price premium?
Right.
I would think so. Now notice, which scotch is a more capital-intensive scotch? How many years of aging whiskey do you need in the pipeline to be getting a supply of 30-year-old scotch versus a supply of 8-year-old scotch?
Right.
You need 30 years accumulation versus 8 years. You need 30 batches in the pipeline to keep up a continuous supply versus 8 batches.
Right.
So which requires the greater capital investment?
30,
the 30-year-old. So now if we had a reduction in the rate of return, all industries that have products and methods of production which require more time-consuming methods, like 30-year-olds versus 8-year-old or whatever, which methods are favored by the reduction in the rate of return? The more capital-intensive. Why? Because the rate of return is exerting less of an influence on the ultimate price of the product, the lower it becomes. If there were no rate of return, if the rate of return were zero, or barely above zero, if there's any product that took more time, that's the one we would go for. It wouldn't make any difference if it takes more time or less, or how much additional capital it required. So from this perspective, too, the lower rate of return brings about a greater capital intensiveness. Now, yet another example. Different industries have different profit margins based on their capital turnover ratios. For example, the supermarket industry typically has a profit margin of about 2%. What is required for the supermarkets, even though their profit margin may be just 2%, what enables them to earn a 10% annual rate of profit on their capital invested?
Volume.
What about the volume?
That's extremely high.
Well,
pardon me?
Cost low.
Well, whatever their costs are relative to the sales, it's 98%. Well, if they have sales equal to 5 times their capital invested, 5 times 2% is 10% on the capital. If you can earn 2% on sales, but your sales are 5 times the capital, well, then you're earning 10% on the capital, right? Now, what about a different kind of industry, perhaps the automobile industry? They would have perhaps a profit margin of 10%. And their capital turnover ratio, their ratio of sales to capital, is a lot lower than a supermarket. Their capital turnover ratio might be 1 to 1. Well, if you earn 10% on sales, and the sales equal the capital, that gives you 10% on capital. Finally, perhaps an electric utility might have a capital turnover ratio of 0.5. Their annual sales might only be equal to half of their capital invested. in that case, what kind of profit margin do you need to make a 10% rate of return on capital? Yes, I heard someone say the right answer. 20%. One half times 20% is 10%. Okay, now let's consider what are the implications of the rate of return on capital falling from 10% to 5%. What kind of effect would there be on the three profit margins in these cases? What would be tending to happen to profit margins in the supermarket business to bring the rate of return down from 10% to 5%? What should we expect to happen to the profit margin in the supermarkets? That should go toward 1%, from 2% to 1%. And if you have a turnover of 5, well, 5 times 1% is now 5%. Now, what about the profit margin in the automobile industry? We have a capital turnover of 1.
5%.
Its profit margin should fall to 5%. And in the electric utility industry, from 20% down to 10%. Now, in which of these industries is in a position to have the greatest reduction in prices that would result in these reductions in profit margins? Pardon me? The utilities. The utilities could sustain a 10% price reduction in the face of the same costs. That would cut their profit margin. The auto industry could sustain a 5% price reduction, and the supermarkets could sustain only a 1% profit margin. Now, in response to these price reductions, which industry do you think would be attracting the greatest increases in quantity demanded? Shouldn't we expect the increases in quantities demanded, at least roughly, to correspond to the degree of price reductions?
Right.
So this should mean that we would have a more powerful tendency toward an increase in quantity demanded of electric power, a lesser increase in automobiles, but that would still be greater than any increase in supermarkets. And so, but which of these industries are the more capital intensive? Which is the more capital intensive as between electric utilities, automobiles, and supermarkets? The electric utilities are the most capital intensive. The automobiles are in the middle, and the supermarkets the least. Why do you need so little capital in a supermarket relative to sales? Well, just think, what is the significant part of the capital invested in? Pardon me?
Structure and inventory.
Well, that's not what gives it a high capital turnover ratio. What contributes to the high capital turnover ratio is such things as fresh produce and dairy products. When do they lay out? When do they buy the dairy products? When do they buy the fresh produce?
Day of.
Probably the day of, maybe at 4 in the morning, and they're selling it the same day. Now imagine that you had we had some little pushcart vendor. How many times would he be turning his capital in a year? He would turn his 365 times in a year. Now, what kind of rate of return would he need to earn a 10% annual return on his capital? It would be a sliver thin, unless he's earning it 365 times. Well, this doesn't take much capital. Now, not all of the capital of the supermarkets is in this type of situation, but to the extent it figures in, the supermarkets are less capital intensive than the auto firms, which in turn are less capital intensive than the electric utilities. And a decline in the rate of profit operates to favor the more capital intensive industries. It's favoring the more capital-intensive industries at the expense of the less capital-intensive industries because it permits greater reductions in their prices than in the prices of the less capital-intensive industries. And what's it doing to methods of production? It's favoring the more capital-intensive methods. That's the ABC case and the railroad tunnel case. It's favoring the more capital-intensive products, the older Scotch case. So it's in these ways that a lower rate of return operates to favor greater capital intensiveness. And this is also a reason why the continuation of negative net investment would be extremely unlikely, at least in a free economy. Because let's say we had a zero rate of profit, and the what's causing the zero rate of profit is negative net investment. Well, at the same time, what types of investments are being favored? More capital intensive, so the negative net investment is not going to go on. There's going to be a switch to having more capital intensive investments, and that will eliminate any negative net investment. And bring the rate of profit at least back up to the rate of net consumption. Now, the rate of net consumption places, when the rate of profit comes to equal the rate of net consumption, whatever that might be, that places a limitation on further increases in capital intensiveness. Whatever rate of profit is being governed by the rate of net consumption, that operates to influence how capital intensive the economy needs to be. It will not be more capital intensive than corresponds to the rate of profit governed by the rate of net consumption. Yes, Mr. Foster.
So I can understand this a little better. When you say that they're favoring more capital intensive businesses for investment, are we looking from the viewpoint of individual investors, like I want to invest in the company, or are we talking about business persons who own the business?
Well, we're talking from both perspectives, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Well, in this way, within a business firm, as between methods A, B, C that we looked at a little while ago, which would the business firm be choosing?
A1.
Well, they don't have the ability to make that choice if they can't make that choice if the sales revenues are going down. When you have sales revenues down to 9,000, which becomes the favored method?
C.
So the business firms are choosing that, right? Now, if the decline in the rate of profit is encouraging the demand for more capital-intensive industries, then you as an individual investor, which would you be more likely to want to invest in? Into the electric utilities. Okay. So the same principle works for both categories. Well, the wider point here is that the rate of return, the aggregate amount of profit in the economy, cannot for very long be below the amount and rate of net consumption. The only thing that could allow that is negative net investment, but the very lowness of the rate of return itself is a counterforce to any negative net investment. It's operating to establish greater capital intensivity, which would eliminate the negative net investment. Now, how does it eliminate it? Well, let's imagine here we are, people are in loss-making businesses. They're in the supermarket industry. It looks terrible. They're just losing money. And yet, calculations are showing in various lines of industry that in the face of their low sales revenues, they could have some hope of profitability if they could bring their costs down. But what do they need to bring their costs down? What do they need to achieve the increased efficiency? More capital investment. Okay, so in various industries, it appears that more capital investment is the means to reestablish profitability. Now, what will happen in unprofitable lines, like our hypothetical supermarket industry, if people are looking at the supermarkets and thinking, well, this is terrible, I'm losing money, I want to get out of this business. And meanwhile, elsewhere in the economy, business firms are attempting to become more capital intensive. They need capital. So what's going to happen to the movement of capital? Won't some capital leave industries like supermarkets and be invested in the process of increasing the capital in other lines of production? That's going to happen. Now, as that happens, what happens to the costs that will show up in the income statements of the supermarkets when you've had a withdrawal of capital and there's some less product being produced?
Costs go down the preceding year.
Well, the costs are going to go down, but people still need food. What's going to happen to profits in the supermarket business? They will be restored. They'll be restored because productive expenditure. Productive expenditure in supermarkets is being cut back, those productive expenditures show up quickly as costs. They're disappearing. The productive expenditures are being made elsewhere in the economy to increase the degree of capital intensiveness. And while that is going on, are they showing up as costs? Are the productive expenditures being made to step up the degree of capital intensiveness, are they showing up as costs right away?
No, they're not.
So what's happened to total costs deducted from sales revenues in the whole economy? Yes? It's gone down. So the costs corresponding to negative net investment are eliminated. Profitability is restored. You'll have profits coming up to the amount of net consumption. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around this example.
Okay.
You mentioned that if the capital expenditures in the supermarket were actually decreased, and the money being spent on capital were moved to other industries.
Yeah, more capital-intensive industries.
Right. Okay. What you had said was that the profits would actually increase. However, wouldn't a decrease in capital investment in that industry decrease the level of efficiencies? You mentioned that people still need to buy goods.
The cost
of doing business is not going to actually go down. It's going to go up because you're not investing in it. Therefore,
good observation. We can modify the example, to satisfy you. The reduction of capital in the supermarkets, let's say we have a lot of supermarkets, they're not doing very well, and suppose we have a merger in supermarkets, okay? And now some of the loss-making supermarkets are closed. And the capital that had been invested in these loss-making supermarkets, as much of it as can be gotten out, that capital might be used to make the remaining supermarkets more capital intensive. And so they would then be more efficient. Okay? So it could work out that way.
Okay.
Okay. Now, while we're looking at this, we can jump forward to an application in Supplement 6, which is not very far removed from what we've been dealing with. Maybe even a couple of applications. Let's turn to F, how the taxation of profits raises the rate of profit. How the taxation of profits raises the rate of profit. Let's say we're going along, we have either no taxes on profits or a certain amount of taxes. The government is now imposing such taxes or increasing them. Where do firms get the money to pay the additional taxes? Let's say we'll use the framework that we've been working with all along. Sales revenues in the economy are 1,000. Initially, what's happening to that 1,000? Firms take in the 1,000. What are they doing with the 1,000 they take in?
Reinvesting.
I mean, they're reinvesting it, but not every last dime.
Either consumption or productive expenditure.
Okay. Now, how much productive expenditure do we have?
500.
I'm hearing 400, 500, and 800.
In the last example?
In the example we were working with, that we had.
We said 200.
No, that was net consumption. I'm asking, what is productive expenditure?
800.
800 is productive expenditure. 500 was the demand for capital goods, and 300 was the demand for labor. Okay, we had net consumption of 200. And so here we are, we have 1,000 of sales revenues. Of those 1,000, 800 are used to make new productive expenditures. 200 are used to finance net consumption. And that generates a fresh 1,000 of sales revenues. And in this process, we identified 200 of profit based on 800 of cost, 800 of productive expenditure. All right, now we'll assume the government imposes a 50% tax on profits. So they want 100 of tax payments. So now business is going to have to turn over 100 to the government. And we can rely on the government to spend the 100, or at least to give it to people who spend it. So what's going to be the effect, first of all, on total sales revenues?
What will be the entire economy?
Yeah, the entire economy.
They go up $100.
Well, the government will spend 100 more. But what happens to the ability of business firms to spend? That goes down 100, right?
So,
so the total sales revenues are going to be unchanged. Pardon me? The businesses will be worse off. Now let's try to calculate where the fall in spending would occur on the part of business. They had been spending 500 for capital goods, 300 in payment of wages, 200 for their own consumption. Well, let's assume that the reduction of 100 available to them is taken out in the same percentages, which would mean they reduce their own consumption by 20, they reduce the payment of wages by 30, and they reduce the demand for capital goods by 50. That adds up to 100, okay? And the government spends the 100. We might imagine the government just buys goods, or the government gives people the money, they spend it. One way or another, we'll have the same total spending. But what spending, there's 100 more of spending coming either from the government or the people to whom the government gives the money. What spending is diminished that offsets that? Oh, we know there's 100 less, but where does it occur? Well, what's happened to the payment of wages to the employees of business?
Reduced it by 30.
That's reduced 30. So total wages are 30 less. The consumption of the wage earners is 30 less. The demand for capital goods is 50 less. The personal consumption of the owners and creditors of business, that's 20 less, right? So these are the things reduced. Okay, now, what is the effect of this? So productive expenditure altogether is reduced by 80, right? 50 of demand for capital goods, 30 of demand for consumers' goods. What's going to be the effect of this on the amount of costs that will show up later on corresponding to this reduced level of productive expenditure? We now have only 720 of productive expenditure. We used to have 800 of productive expenditure showing up as 800 of costs. Now we have 720 of productive expenditure. How much cost will that show up as? How much cost will 720 of productive expenditure generate?
Still going to have the 100 taxes to pay?
Pardon me?
Still have 100?
Yeah, there's 100 taxes, but what I want to ask is what's going to happen to, you see, when you have, you report normal costs first, and then you show profits, and then you'll show taxes and profits after tax. So we're interested, first of all, in calculating what's going to be the effect of this reduction in productive expenditure, insofar as it occurs, to provide the funds with which to pay the taxes. What will be the effect of that on the costs that will be deducted from the sales revenues in calculating pre-tax profits? Pardon me?
You don't have as much to spend.
The costs will be less, right? What should we expect total cost to be?
-30%.
720. We should expect if productive expenditure goes from 800 to 720, and we used to have costs of 800 corresponding to productive expenditure of 800, well, now we should end up with costs of only 720. Is there someone who doesn't see that?
Right.
That if we have less productive expenditure, we should have less cost. Well, if that's where we end up, what has happened to
pre-tax profits.
Gone up.
Pre-tax profits are higher. They're now, instead of 200, they're 280.
That's assuming that sales revenue is going to stay the same.
Yes.
However, if you buy your goods,
yeah,
and you're spending less for goods, you know, less inventory,
yeah,
it's safe to assume that literally the goods that you're selling would then reduce.
Now,
so if you're buying less, mm-hmm, then your sales revenue would less, then your profit would stay the same.
Well, no. You see, you might end up with less physical goods produced and less available to sell, but that doesn't mean the amount of spending will be less. See, if we have the same, if it's the case that what's governing the volume of spending is the quantity of money, and we still have the same quantity of money, well, we might have less goods, or in other scenarios we have more goods. We've dealt with scenarios where we've had rising production from year to year, right?
Right.
Okay, what was happening to total spending as production went up?
Spending as production went up?
Yeah, if we didn't have any increase in the quantity of money.
Would it go down? Less?
Did the total
production
spending
go up? Spending would go up.
Spending would go up.
Because you're paying less for it.
Well, if production is going up, here we are. Okay. Take the example of what's happened in the computer peripheral industry. What has happened to the production of megabytes or gigabytes of hard drive storage space? The price has gone up. The physical supply has gone up astronomically, right? Has the revenue derived from these things remotely kept pace?
No.
I remember roughly 20 years ago, I apologize if I've already mentioned this, I paid $2,500 for a 40 megabyte hard drive. Very recently, I paid $250 for a 250 gigabyte hard drive. Now, if you divide 250 gigabytes by 40 megabytes, that's, what, 6,000 times or more, and the price is actually less. We've had staggering increases in production. That doesn't mean that the revenues are going up, certainly not to anywhere near the same degree.
Due to efficiency.
In this case, mainly due to efficiency, yes. Now, you could have a reverse movement. Suppose we were in a declining economy, and 20 years from now, if we still have computers, the average hard drive is back to 40 megabytes. Do you think that would mean that we'd have less being spent in 20 years? I would imagine, if anything, there'd be tons more being spent. Because what would actually help to produce such a scenario would be radical inflation. That's one of the things that could drive us back physically. So the volume of spending and the volume of production are really not the same issue. There are many instances in which if an industry produces more, its sales revenues will go up. In what sort of case will that be? If you recall a microeconomics course, you had a concept, elasticity of demand.
Pardon me?
Well, it might. What type of demand curve do you need so that when production goes up, the amount of spending goes up? Yes?
Elastic.
I'm sorry?
Inelastic.
Well, no, it's elastic.
Elastic.
They had elastic in the answer. It's just the prefix that was wrong. Okay, now, but there are other cases where if the quantity goes up, the revenue goes down. What sorts of cases are they? Pardon me?
Yes.
An inelastic demand. Suppose, for example, right now, the supply of oil were to go up 10%. What do you think the effect would be on the price of oil? Would it drop 2%, 10%? Well, I think more likely it would drop substantially more than 10%. Maybe drop 25 or 30%. if the supply of cigarettes went up, if the cigarette companies wanted to sell 5% more cigarettes than they're now selling, what kind of price reductions do you think they'd have to have? Do you think they could say, hey, we've just cut the price 4%? Pardon me? Okay, now just take that example. When the price of cigarettes goes up, what happens to the sales volume? The physical volume goes down. What about the dollar volume? That goes up. So now, if the reverse occurs, what do you think will happen to the sales to the dollar volume? It goes down. It's not going to go up when the price goes up and when the price goes down. When the price goes down, the dollar volume of sales will go down. So there are many industry demand curves. There are all kinds of individual industry demand curves, such that when the supply goes up, the sales revenue go up. That's the case in industries that have an elastic demand. But then there are just as many other cases in which when the supply goes up, the sales revenues goes down. That's the case with an inelastic demand. But in neither case is there an implication for what happens in the overall economy. Suppose we have cases where individual industries are producing more, their sales revenues go down. What are people doing with the money they no longer spend in buying from those industries? They're buying from other industries. When food becomes more abundant and the price of food goes down, people spend less buying food. That's the foundation of their having the money available to buy all sorts of other things. Okay, so there's no decline in the overall economy. Then when there are some things that are in lesser supply, well, sometimes the sales revenue goes up, as with oil. What would happen to the spending for oil today if some pipeline in Saudi Arabia were blown up? It would skyrocket. Suppose we have 2 or 3% less oil available than we presently have available. Now, if there's 2 or 3% less oil available, that means that 2 or 3% of the use of oil has to be eliminated. Okay, well, what are people going to do before they freeze? They'll be trying to buy more, but what kind of price will be needed so that people will say, well, I just got to freeze? It's got to be a very, very steep rise in price, or I just can't drive my car. So less supply of oil would mean increased revenues, not decreased, for the oil industry. But what would it do to the rest of the economy? It would decrease revenues in the rest of the economy. So overall, total revenues in the whole economy are neutral with respect to supply. You can have developments that increase supply. That's not going to increase total spending. It will serve to reduce prices. You can have developments that reduce total supply. That operates to raise prices, not reduce total spending. Now, coming back to our analysis of the effect of the profits tax, here we are. We've imposed this 50% profits tax, and we've traced the matter to the point of seeing that productive expenditure falls from 800 to 720. Okay, and that means that costs will fall from 800 to 720. But meanwhile, what's happened to total sales revenues? That stays the same. So what has happened to total profit in the economy on a pre-tax basis? It's now 280 instead of 200. And then, of course, if we still have the 50% tax rate, well, now firms will have to pay 140 in taxes. And what will be the effect of that on productive expenditure?
Decrease.
It'll cut it further. At some point, we'll end up with an equilibrium. Notice the cut is not as great this time. The next time it'll be even smaller. We would reach some equilibrium Possibly it might be profits are 300, profits taxes are 150, and productive expenditure is stable at 700. I don't know if it would be exactly there. But the key point is the effect of a tax on profits is to raise the pre-tax amount and by implication the pre-tax rate of profit. Now look a little bit further and consider is this a positive development for the economy? Now the pre-tax rate of profit is higher than it used to be. Is that something, should we say, boy, we know how to turn things around. Let's go out and raise profit taxes. That will raise the pre-tax rate of profit. What's the significance of a rise in the pre-tax rate of profit in this context, where it's brought about in this way? Pardon me?
End up paying more taxes.
Well, you're paying more taxes, but notice what has happened to the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. It's less. We've already traced the demand for capital goods down to 450. That was on round one. And the demand for consumers' goods having risen to 550. Well, what difference is made by the demand for consumers' goods rising from 500 to 550 and the demand for capital goods falling from 500 to 450? What does that signify in terms of the ability to accumulate capital? It's reduced. And if the assumptions we used in constructing our diagrams applied, well, what would be happening to the supply of capital goods from year to year? If you have 1K and a 50-50 breakdown is needed to replace the 1K that's used up, what happens when you're only devoting 45% of your efforts to producing capital goods? Then you're producing fewer capital goods than you're using up. What does that do to your ability to produce the following year? It will decrease it. And what has happened to wages? They're decreased. And what happens to the extent that a reduced ability to produce cuts the supply of consumers' goods and starts raising the prices of consumers' goods because there's less and less of them? What is that doing to real wages?
Reducing them.
Okay. So we see a number of things here resulting from the effect of raising taxes on profits. The pre-tax rate of profit goes up, true enough. But the rise in the rate of profit in such circumstances, for such reasons, is negatively related to economic progress and prosperity. It has an inverse relationship. And now, suppose you had a tax proposal saying, we don't want the little guy to pay any taxes. Little guys shouldn't pay taxes. We want all the taxes to be paid by the fat cats. And there is no shortage of people who say this. Okay, what would be the effect? Suppose we were to have a new tax policy.
Walmart.
We'll eliminate the income tax for everyone earning less than $50,000 a year, let's say. And we'll make up for the loss by increasing the rates on people making over $100,000 or over $200,000. Now, what effect do you think this would have on the volume of productive expenditure and the pre-tax rate of profit? Or to make it more easily dovetail with what we've been talking about, we eliminate taxation on everyone making less than $50,000, and we make up for the loss by raising the corporate income tax.
The prices get passed on.
What will happen?
The real wages will fall down.
Real wages will fall and could well fall progressively, year in and year out. So while this appears to be a little guy's program, it doesn't really work out that way. Now, suppose we did the opposite. Suppose we manage somehow to cut government spending by 100 and reduce taxes on corporations and people who save and productively expend heavily. We reduce their taxes, so now productive expenditure rises. What will happen to the pre-tax rate of profit? See, if corporations, which is the simplest case to deal with, I guess, if corporations had to pay less tax, or suppose they didn't have to pay any tax, what would they be doing with the money they used to pay in taxes and no longer have to? Mainly, overwhelmingly, they'd be using it to make productive expenditures. They'd be buying capital goods, they'd be paying additional wages, the government would be consuming 100 less, or the people the government gave money to would consume 100 less. Business firms would be spending perhaps 80 more in productive expenditures, another 20 for their own consumption. So sales revenues rise in one end and they fall in another. Overall, they net out. But productive expenditure is up, and what would be the effect on pre-tax profits?
There's no taxes.
There's no taxes, so the taxes are eliminated, and then what would happen is the taxes would be replaced with costs on account of materials, machinery, and wages. Instead of having costs on account of taxes, their place would be taken by expenditure for capital goods and labor. And what difference does that make to production?
Produces productivity.
Now we produce much more.
Right.
And more people are working or working at better pay. And certainly we produce more capital goods, and our chance of having capital accumulation and economic progress is greatly increased. So, but notice the common denominator here with our analysis of net consumption and profits is that insofar as anything operates to, on the one side, maintain sales revenues, and on the other side, reduce productive expenditure. If you have something that's maintaining sales revenues and reducing productive expenditure, sooner or later it's reducing costs and thus doing what to profits?
Increasing
profits. And essentially the same analysis applies to government budget deficits. Insofar as they're financed by what is called borrowing from the public. And this is point G, how government budget deficits raise the rate of profit. There are two ways of financing deficits. One way is to go and borrow money from the citizens. That's called borrowing from the public. The other way is for the government to print the money. And we'll assume for the time being that they're financing the deficits by borrowing from the citizens. Well, when the government borrows money from the citizens, we have to ask, what would the citizens have done with this money had they not been lending it to the government?
Saving us.
They would. It's already saved. That's how they have it available to lend to anybody. If they've saved it, what would be happening to savings if the savings are not having to be lent to the government? They'd be invested in business, and that would mean they'd be financing the purchase of capital goods and the payment of wages. They'd be used to finance productive expenditures. So a government deficit financed by borrowing from the public means that funds that otherwise would have been productively expended are instead diverted into consumption. Well, A, what's the effect on overall total economy-wide sales revenues? They're the same, no effect there. But what's the effect of less productive expenditure on costs? On total costs? Total costs go down. Total costs go down. So what's the effect on profits? They're higher. But this is not a happy development, really, because it's, in this context, the rise in profits and economic progress and prosperity are inversely related. Now, just to nail this down a little bit further, to avoid any possible confusion, here we are, we're saying total costs go down. Bear in mind, we're talking about total costs, the total number of dollars deducted from sales revenue. That's what goes down. But to the extent that the physical volume of production might also go down, because we have possibly capital decumulation, we're not producing enough capital goods to replace the capital goods being used up, so we're getting less production. What will be the effect not on economy-wide total costs, but on unit costs? Unit costs would be going up. Unit costs can go up as total costs go down. Now, that's not any kind of contradiction. The total costs go down because productive expenditure has gone down. And unit costs go up because a consequence of productive expenditure going down is that we have an insufficient demand for capital goods. We no longer are producing enough capital goods to replace the capital goods being used up, so our ability to produce declines. And as our ability to produce declines, well, we get less and less products. And even though the total cost is less, let's say total cost is 10% less, well, what's happened to unit cost as soon as the supply of goods is more than 10% less? So imagine total costs are 10% less, 720 instead of 800. But the supply of products produced is half as great as it used to be. Well, then unit costs would be 2 times 0.9. That would be total costs are 90% of what they used to be, but we have only half as much produced. So the unit costs are twice as great. We're dividing 0.9 by a half. If you divide 0.9 by a half, well, then that's 1.8. So unit costs would be 1.8, and total costs are 0.9. So total costs and unit costs in this context go in an opposite direction. Okay, I hope these implications are understandable and of some interest. I think they have a bearing on current discussions about taxes. We can change the tax system either to impede economic progress or to remove it from standing in the way. We can make the tax system work in a way that allows economic progress to proceed at a much more rapid rate. Okay, let's take our break here, and we'll pick this up in 25 minutes.